This is VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, we have a story about a Ukrainian woman and a Russian man who chose to not give up on their hopes of being together. Jill Robbins and Dan Novak present this week's Education Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, Maria Vyevska is from Ukraine. Yuri Korochkin is from Russia. Both are 23 years old. They fell in love while playing an online video game. Their relationship began before Russia invaded Ukraine last February. With their nations at war, the chances of them continuing their relationship were low. But the couple has beaten the odds. Vyevska was living near Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Korochkin was living in St. Petersburg in Russia. Although they lived far apart, the couple did not give up. "It wasn't hard," said Vyevska, smiling. "I wasn't afraid, not at all. I am happy, because I am loved." Korochkin described how the couple started making plans to meet in person. "It was a year ago. I started to organize my international passport to visit Maria in Ukraine," Korochkin said. "I finished it in January. And as you know, the war started in February, and it crashed all our plans. There seemed to be little hope of them meeting in person after Russia invaded Ukraine." Vyevska and Korochkin were at a loss. She moved to Czechia soon after the war started, while he stayed at home in Russia. But still, they did not give up. "They started considering some options to live together," said Korochkin. "They decided to go to Serbia. The Slavic nation in the Balkans has remained friendly with Russia, and Russians can enter without a visa." Serbia's capital, Belgrade, was where Vyevska and Korochkin met for the first time. "I arrived to Serbia on the 27th of April, and I waited for her for several days," Korochkin said. "She arrived from the Czech Republic, and we met each other at the central bus station." "He was all that she imagined," said Vyevska. "There was this moment of unbelievable joy," she said. "I traveled for 16 hours and had no sleep. I couldn't sleep. So I came out of the bus and I fell into his arms." Their new life together began immediately. They first stayed in a hotel for young people before finding a small apartment just outside Belgrade. They took up different jobs while studying online at a St. Petersburg university. Life together has not been without its problems, however. Last July, pro-Russian extremists in Serbia drew a huge Z sign, a symbol of Russia's invasion, on their building. Attackers broke into their home. "They were also attacked by a violent mob," Korochkin said. "We talk about the war sometimes, but we don't have any problems between each other," he said. For Vyevska, the biggest concern has been how she will be seen by other Ukrainians because of her relationship. She notes that her own family has no objections to the relationship. "What happens next, we'll see," she said. We don't know what happens tomorrow. Kurochkin said the couple will just take things as they come. We are happy because we are together.
Hundreds of thousands of American students have dropped out of public schools since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. They have essentially gone missing from schools. An examination by the Associated Press, Stanford University's Big Local News Project, and Stanford education professor Thomas Dee reached some of the missing students. They found an estimated 240,000 students in 21 states whose absences from school could not be explained. These students did not move out of state. They did not sign up for private school or homeschool. Missing students received a lot of attention in 2020 after the pandemic closed schools around the country. In the years since, however, missing students have largely become a budgeting problem. School leaders and some state officials worried about how they would lose financing if the students did not return. More students means more money from the city, state, and federal governments. There is no longer urgency to find the students who disappeared from school. Early in the pandemic, school workers would go to students' homes to try and help them return to the classroom. Most such efforts, however, have ended.
The missing students identified by the AP and Stanford represent more than just a number. The study represents thousands of students who may have missed out on the basics of reading and other skills in kindergarten and first grade. Discussion of children's recovery from the pandemic has centered largely on test scores and performance. But Dee, the Stanford expert, said the data suggests a need to understand more about children who are not in school and how that will affect their growth. This is leading evidence that tells us we need to be looking more carefully at the kids who are no longer in public schools, he said. Over months of reporting, the AP learned of students and families avoiding school for many reasons. Some are still afraid of COVID-19. Others are homeless or have left the country. Some students could not study online and found jobs instead. During the long period of online learning, some students fell so far behind that they no longer knew how to behave or learn at school. Many of these students are still officially on school rosters. That makes it harder to truly count the number of missing students. The real number of young people not receiving an education is likely much higher than 240,000.
The AP and Big Local News found that public school enrollment fell by 710,000 students between the 2019-20 and 2021-22 school years. That number includes the 21 states that provided the necessary data. It also includes numbers from Washington, D.C. Those states saw private school enrollment grow by over 100,000 students. Homeschooling grew even more, increasing by more than 180,000. But the data showed 240,000 students who were neither in private school nor attending homeschool. Their absences could not be explained by population loss, like falling birth rates, or families who moved out of state. States where kindergarten is not required were more likely to have larger numbers of students who are unaccounted for. That suggests the missing students also include many young learners who have stayed at home instead of starting school. The true number of missing students across the country is likely much higher. The study does not include data from 29 states or the unknown numbers of so-called ghost students, children who are enrolled in school but rarely make it to class. Officials of the Unified School District of Los Angeles, California, have spoken about attempts to find unschooled students and help remove barriers that prevent them from coming to school. The district has offered clothes washing services and help with housing. But some students and their parents say their problem is with a school system that they say has failed their children.
Allison Hertog represents more than 30 families whose children missed a lot of time learning when California's classrooms closed for more than a year early in the pandemic. She said, "Parents are bereft." In other words, parents feel hopeless and are without necessary support. Los Angeles student Ezekiel West is in fourth grade, but reads at a first grade reading level. Before the pandemic shutdowns, he moved from school to school when educators could not deal with his poor behavior. During online learning, Ezekiel's mother had trouble getting internet for her son to attend class. When Ezekiel returned to school in the fall of 2021 as a third grader, Ezekiel was unhappy that other students had made more progress than he had. A California judge ruled that Los Angeles's schools had violated Ezekiel's rights. The judge ordered the city's school district to give Ezekiel a place at a new school, with a special plan to ease him back into learning and building trust with his teachers. The school did not follow the plan. Last October, his mother stopped sending him to school. Last month, Ezekiel signed up for a public online school for California students. Hertog, his lawyer, is worried that the program will not work for someone with Ezekiel's needs. The family is looking for yet another choice. At least three of the students Hertog has represented have been missing from school for long periods since in-person learning restarted. Their situations, she said, were avoidable. She added, "It's pretty disgraceful that the school systems allowed this to go on for so long." I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Dan joins me now to talk more about his story. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to see you again, Ashley.
Today's story is about students who have gone missing or have been absent from school since classes returned to in-person learning after online learning during the pandemic. Researchers estimate the number of missing students to be at 240,000. That is really high.
Yes, it's a concerning number, and the number is almost certainly higher than 240,000. That doesn't even include data from 29 states. Also, there's many students that are included in school rosters, or lists of students, that just aren't coming to class. It's hard to count an exact number of those students.
Why are so many students missing?
That's a good question, and it's a complicated answer. There is no single reason why. But we know the pandemic put a huge stress on students and the education system as a whole. When classes went online, many were in a poor position to succeed. They may not have had a good computer or had poor internet access. Many kids dealt with mental or emotional problems related to pandemic lockdowns. So it's very possible that tens of thousands of students just didn't feel prepared to return to classes in person, either for academic or emotional reasons, or both.
You have to wonder how those missed years of school will affect those students' growth.
Yes, that's going to be a big question for educators in the next couple years, I'm afraid.
Well, thanks for your report today, and thanks for joining me on the show.
You're welcome.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world. As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. Public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge sugar trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the sugar trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So, Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. But the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.